Policy Heads, welcome back to episode 10 today. We will be discussing about COVID-19 and its impact on women and gender. We have here with us Associate Professor Leah Rupina. So Leah is an Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Melbourne School of Social and Political Sciences. She is also the co-director of the Policy Lab. She is an expert in the issues of gender, family and public policy. And her research works mainly comprise topics such as maternal employment, female representation in government, and gender inequality in the home. In fact, she just published her new book this year called Motherlands, How States Push Mothers Out of Employment, which is about the US states varying their, you know, childcare policies, gender empowerment, and maternal employment, which is really great. So welcome to the podcast, Leah, and really, really good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I sounded so smart in that introduction. I loved it.
You are. I know you, and you are really smart. You're amazing. Tell us a little bit about your latest research, COVID-19 affect women, gender inequality in general, and in comparison to pre-COVID, what's been happening?
Okay, so I usually like to bring good news because I'm American, but I am not hopeful about what COVID-19 means for women. There's a couple of reasons why I think this is going to be really actually currently is and will continue to be extremely disastrous for women specifically. So there's a couple of things going on. The first is that COVID-19 is knocking women out of employment at higher rates than men. You can see this first in part because it's hitting industries that are female dominated. So thinking about things like tourism or restaurants, the things that are going to be slow to recover are often female dominated industries. So now I'm not talking about like the childcare or the teachers. Those are also female dominated, but I'm talking about kind of these more service economy oriented things. Although there is a question mark, what's going to happen with childcare if kids can't go back to the care, right? Because of the virus. In addition to it knocking out certain industries or resulting in certain industries to be slow to recover, we also have to, economists have also shown that even within industries, because women tend to occupy lower status jobs, they tend to be at the bottom of the hierarchy, that those, you know, the casual workers or whatever, those have been the first jobs to go. So even within industry, women are disproportionately shouldering unemployment, reduced work hours, or being just kind of fired. So that's the one thing, that's like the economic side. The home side is that what we know from existing research is that women do the bulk of the housework and the childcare. The gender norms place women in the role of the caregiver. And so if they're unemployed at high rates and they're also managing these unequal domestic loads at home, that it's going to be really hard for them to get a foothold into the economy. The other thing I'm worried about, and it's the final thing I'll say, is I am really worried about kind of reverting back to traditional gender norms, that if jobs become scarce and women can't get employment and the kids are home, that we might go back to being kind of this idea that men should be breadwinners and women should be homemakers. And I'm worried that that in the long term also is going to confound kind of the 50 years of gender progress that we've seen. So there's a lot to be worried about. There's a lot of troubling evidence about what this looks like for women.
I think coming from a perspective of a single woman, and as our listeners are also like young listeners, generally speaking, why should we care about this issue?
I think that young people and young women in particular can feel all of this kind of pressure around COVID. What we know already is that young people have a harder time getting a foothold in the market. They tend to go into casual work. They tend to have high job churn. It's so hard to come out of your undergraduate or graduate degree and get stable, long-term, continuous employment. That was happening before COVID, right? Young people are disproportionately in the gig economy, and we're not talking about people without resources. We're talking about your Uber being driven by people with master's degrees who are just doing that to supplement their income on the side. So this was all happening before COVID-19. Now, what this means for young women, and in particular looking to the future, is I think employment is going to be more difficult to get. Stable employment, you can see this from the previous recession, that when the economy contracts, people hold on to their jobs for longer periods of time. People that would have retired or moved on or done something different, that's problematic for young people because that money needs to be freed up to allow for young people to enter the labor market. So that's one piece of it. I think second and related to that is the question about what's the future of work going to look like? And Sheila, you and I have done a little bit of work on this, but what does the future of work look like? What kind of skills do you need for the future of work? Are women equipped for that? And is COVID-19 going to accelerate the processes that were already happening? I'm going to bet yes. I'm going to bet you're going to see movement towards automation and artificial intelligence replacing employment to accelerate, in part because people are looking to cut costs. But also, you know, there's arguments too that these robots don't get sick. So if this pandemic stays for a long period of time and you need someone to do this kind of automated labor, that now's the moment to make that investment as an industry. So that's like kind of the work side for women that makes me worried, and young women in particular, young people in particular. Are they going to be able to get the secure jobs that it's shown they haven't been able to historically? Are they going to have the skills for the future labor force? Question mark. And then what do their family lives look like? So we know that actually young people and young women in particular want to have equal divisions of housework. They want equal sharing. They're more egalitarian, especially highly educated women. This is true also of men. Men want to be equal sharers. They want to have a different family, work-family balance than perhaps their parents had. They want to have a different family life than perhaps their parents had. They're highly skilled. You know, we have some of the highest levels of education coming through. Women are surpassing men in their access to college degrees, university degrees. So they're more educated than men, and they want equality at home. The challenge is what the data shows is once you have kids, it's not what is the result. So you have a desire for equality, but you live within an institutional structure that doesn't allow it. And that is where I think it's not even a story of young versus old, but it's just we haven't updated our systems, right? Our systems are stuck in the 1950s, where we expect men to be the breadwinner, or someone to be the breadwinner, and someone to do all the homemaking in a country like the Australia or the US or the UK. So I think for young people, can I just tell you, this was probably 10 years ago, there was an interesting study that came out of Yale or Princeton, I think, one of the Ivy Leagues in the US. Mm-hmm. And they asked young women, what do you want to be, what do you envision yourself being in your careers in the future? And a huge portion of them said they are going to be housewives. Now, do we really think that Ivy League women, smartest, brightest women, are destined or desired to be housewives? The answer is stay-at-home moms, right? The answer is, I think they're looking forward to their futures, and they know how difficult it is going to be balancing work and family. They know that work hours are long, and we know from the sociological literature that highly educated women marry highly educated men. So high career, they're dual career couples. They're both going to be working 70, 80 hours as lawyers. And if you want to have a kid, the way in which we've structured our work lives is incompatible with investing in our children, right? Like, we just don't have the bandwidth to have two careers where people are working 70, 80 hours a week and also have the demands of children. And women are anticipating that they're going to be the ones who step out of that or take the hit. That's what the literature shows, that in these high earning couples, women do drop out in part to support the family, but also to support their husband's careers. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, a sociologist did this study where she looked at this opting out of highly educated women and then followed them 20 years later. They don't re-enter the labor market at the same rates. They actually stay part-time, or they never re-enter at the same levels that they were before. So I think for young women, they're thinking about all this. They're weighing it all in their heads. They're thinking, how am I going to get a job? I'm highly, you know, I'm smart. I'm getting my degrees. And what does my future look like? Mm-hmm. And I think before COVID, it looked stressful and it looked hard and it looked like, how are we going to do all of this? And now with COVID, all of that probably feels worse, more stressful, more uncertain. And if we know that young people are slow to get married and get houses and have their kids, I think this is going to push it all out. Now, do you want the good news? I think the only potential good news is that this COVID-19 has shown that what we were doing is unsustainable. And it's not, it's unsustainable for young people, it's unsustainable for middle-aged people, and it's unsustainable for old people. So if we start to shift our culture and start to shift our institutions so that we're valuing things like productivity, as opposed to time at work, then we're valuing things like flexible work, but not just for women. we're valuing things like childcare for everyone, that you will start to see equalizing of gender relations in the home. And then you really will see that women can enter employment at equal rates to men. And that will be a positive thing. But in addition to that, you need to make sure that young people have actual career pathways.
I've got another question. It might be slightly off the domain that you're focusing on, but is there any particular hints of information about how COVID-19 is affecting transgender communities, especially transgender women? Also in relation to that, what does the gender-based violence look like as well?
Oh my God, for trans community or
for women generally? In general?
Mm-hmm. Okay. The question about the trans community is incredibly important, and I don't think we have enough research to speak to this fully, to the experience. This is something that should be front and center in the research agenda. We should be understanding how marginalized communities are experiencing the COVID-19 pandemic, and thinking about this beyond our traditional assumptions around race, class, and gender, to also include the trans community within this, is an incredibly important area for future research. What I would anticipate is happening is that the trans community, much in the way that other marginalized groups are being disproportionately affected by COVID-19, are also experiencing this disadvantage. But this is more reason why we should make this a central research agenda and to understand this more fully. And to co-design it with the with members of the trans community to speak to actually the lived experiences at this moment in time. In terms of domestic violence, that's an interesting question because I think the current evidence is showing that there's increased incidence, but it's hard to know because the reporting mechanisms have disappeared on some level. In that, what I mean by that is if you anticipate that third parties are reporting, that like teachers or coaches or people who are having contact with the family that are not within the family, that if now everyone's inside, no longer is the teacher seeing the kid every day or the mother every day when they drop their kid off to school. Mm-hmm. Especially in areas in which lockdowns are happening, like we're in right now in particular. And it's important to acknowledge that this is not home. Many homes are unhealthy, you know, are not safe spaces for women and children. And that this is another example of the ways in which COVID-19 will make life worse for some groups that are already disadvantaged. So yeah, I think that there is some preliminary evidence showing that it's increasing, but also I guess what I'm trying to say is it's probably not the true number, because if we really had all the other people, third party people who are reporting on this type of stuff, reporting the violence, that's not the family. If those kind of indicate those kind of advocates or those, I want to call them like heroes, but like, yeah, those heroes are there being the eyes and ears for the vulnerable, then we must be undercounting. It must be undercounted. So if it's going up, it's not actually a true indication. It's probably much higher than what we have in official statistics.
Can I come back to the question about the work balance between men and women? During COVID-19, because, you know, there's a lot of changing policies like working from home, and we know that from your research that women are doing a lot more than pre-COVID. Does that also apply to men? Do they also work more?
Do you mean doing more housework or doing more paid work?
Oh, what has your research found?
Okay, so thank you very much for the opportunity to showcase my own work. So we found a couple of things. We've done a study where we've looked at unpaid domestic time, well, and paid work time, comparing the U.S. and Australia. And we surveyed people right at the beginning of that first lockdown. So that was happening simultaneously in the U.S. and simultaneously in Australia. I remember way back in April when we were first kind of learning it was emerging and everyone went into their initial shutdown of the world economy. What we found from that study was that we could see at that moment in time, so I'm just giving a caveat, at that moment in time, what we show is that women are saying that they're doing much, much more housework and much, much more childcare. Men are also saying that they're doing more. So everyone's housework and childcare time at that moment in time increased. It's important, however, to note that women have always done more. So if you're doing much, much more and you always did more, you're doing even more, right? The gender gaps have the potential to widen. There's some evidence coming out of Australia that men are doing more. That's narrowing the gender gap a little bit, but women are actually still doing more. There's some evidence in the US, a really interesting study that was done by colleagues of mine, American sociologists, where they showed that actually men were saying they were doing a lot more of the work than women were saying men were doing. So
interesting.
Yeah, okay, take a minute on that. I know that's a bit confusing, but basically women were more likely to say they were doing all of it. Men were much more likely to say that they were sharing or doing more. And what was interesting is, like, I don't know, maybe 25% of men thought that they were doing all the housework, childcare, and homeschooling, and maybe 3% of women or 1% of women thought their husband was doing all of that. So there's a mismatch in that kind of in that expectation. I have a study where we show actually when couples are mismatched in how they're viewing their housework. So if men are saying they're doing more, but women are saying they're doing more, so basically one of them is not right, right? Someone's lying in this, that these couples are much more likely to break up. Women are more likely to think about divorcing that person, like leaving that person, breaking up with that person. And we followed them over time and found that they do actually split. So this idea, so housework is a really important role or kind of mechanism through which couples can end up breaking up. It's not unimportant. So that's kind of on the domestic side. On the domestic side, what we're seeing is that men are doing more, but women are picking up even more. And so therefore women remain disadvantaged. In terms of employment, we have some data coming out of the US where we're showing that women are dropping out of employment at higher rates. That even we took couples where both could telecommute. So this idea that, like, maybe actually if just everyone's working from home, they can share the childcare and stuff and it'll be okay. We didn't find that. We found that actually mothers of little kids were dropping their employment still, even if they could do like what we're doing right now, Zoom into their office. And so in the long term, we have real concerns about what this means for women's employment, in part because if we are a face-to-face culture where we think that good employees are those who are there all day long, and they're not interrupted by their family demands, and they can give the employer 12 hours a day, that if women have any sort of kind of indication that they're not there 100% of the time, what does that mean for their futures, right? And also, if you're taking any gaps in employment are really problematic too. And so even if you take a temporary leave to take care of your kids to take care of your childcare demands or your caregiving demands because you're caring for an elderly or sick family member, that those gaps can have real long-term consequences. They can be very difficult for you to re-enter and very difficult for you to be promoted and very difficult for you to be seen as serious about work and experience some gender discrimination. Right?
And beyond working culture as well, how do these like foreseen effects of COVID-19 to women affect women's future, such as, like, we know that superannuation now has a lot of gender gap, and with, you know, like women dropping out of employment now, do you have any like general thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so pre-COVID, and this is speaking to Australian audience, pre-COVID there was a huge number of women who had zero superannuation. So at time of retirement they had literally no money. I think it was like one in three women. It's a huge percentage. So imagine, again, let's think about everything that was happening pre-COVID. Let's think about all the forms of inequality that existed before this major global event that is now creating even more inequality. Yeah, so women hold less superannuation. And in Australia, a huge percentage of women have no superannuation. This is deeply problematic if we know that the divorce rate is 1 in 2. And we know that couples don't stay together. And therefore, if you're kind of investing in your family or your husband's career, that then in the long term, you break up, then that investment disappears, right? And you end up, one of the biggest drivers of women into poverty is, into homelessness is in poverty is divorce. So this is problematic. Under COVID-19, we had, in our study, we showed that actually women were much more worried about they're pulling on their retirement at higher levels. And we found that their anxiety was higher about that. Like, they were really worried about not having enough money to retire on. For young women, which is, like, I know a bit your audience, one of the things that was said to me when I was a young woman that I thought was really, really good advice and was not how I was thinking about my future or my life in any way, shape, or form, was that, you know, oftentimes you think about these, like, dropping out of employment Oftentimes we think about trades between employment and say childcare as being rational, one-to-one. So sometimes women will say things like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to actually reduce to part-time or drop out of employment because my whole salary is going to go to childcare. That's true, but children age out of childcare quickly, right? Like they're only in childcare for say 5 years. And the amount of money that you lose in terms of superannuation investments, in terms of, you know, kind of losing your skill set, because in 5 years, the labor market looks really different than in the past. Or in terms of putting money, promotion, so putting money into your superannuation, maintaining your skills and getting your promotion, staying within the ladder and working your way up the corporate ladder or whatever the hierarchy, it is so much more than that short little gap. So anyway, so that's like my little caveat sign. You can edit that out or keep it in. But I think for COVID-19, what you're going to see is that if women are being knocked out of employment, which is your point, if women are being knocked out at higher rates, and there is all this discussion about whether COVID is going to drive divorce, that you're going to see the long-term earnings. It's a short-term negative consequence. It's going to have serious consequences for women's employment and their family finances in the short term, but also in the potential in the long term. Because they're going to have less superannuation, less retirement, and relationships may be less stable after everyone's been home together.
And just a little bit of the current policy. A couple of months ago when the lockdown was first introduced, the government gave the childcare subsidy. Now it has ended. How does that impact women in their work?
Yeah, okay. So the government, not just the Australian government, but governments around the world, are now going to have to figure out which types of lifelines to throw out to their economy, because the economic, I mean, I don't know if you've seen you or your listeners have seen the graphs where they show the unemployment rates relative to other downturns. And you're looking at a graph, right? And you can see like, you know, the GFC or the Great Depression. And then the pandemic, it's like you have to scroll down the page 8 times to see how, where the unemployment rate is coming right now. So this is something that we've never seen before in modern history in terms of its economic implications, in terms of the number of unemployed people, the unemployment, the business closures, just in the interconnectedness of the economy. So the result of that is that governments at this moment in time are going to have to think about the ways in which they're going to try to stimulate the economy to get people back to work. And that means they're going to use money. They're going to throw lifelines out. They're going to give levers to certain groups, but not others. My concern is that they're going to throw lifelines to the groups that are kind of male-dominated industries or things that historically have been engines for economic growth. Manufacturing.
Yeah.
Construction. That's kind of my two, manufacturing and construction. The challenge is the Australian economy is no longer a manufacturing economy. It's a service economy. And women are disproportionately within the service economy. Mm-hmm. So when you ask me about the childcare credit, I think if you're going to throw $50,000 out to help people remodel their bathroom, right, which was one of the Australian government's approach, then there is no reason why you can't give families $50,000 to pay for their childcare. The government has since removed that childcare credit. But think about it another way too, because for young people, why isn't the money coming out to young people if we know that they are the future spenders? I mean, it's purely selfish actually to invest in your young people, in part because they're going to be your future taxpayers, your future parents, your future spenders. You all are going to drive the economy. You're 10 years away from being in your kind of like max income, 10 to 10 years. You're 10 years away from starting to be in your peak consumption. So 30 to 45, right? We're throwing the most money into the economy by buying goods, whatever, because you have your highest earnings. So another question would be like thinking about not just the childcare, but where are the lifelines going to go? And why are we going to go to the traditional routes of like kind of male-dominated industry, manufacturing, construction? Or are we going to use these lifelines to be innovative? Think about, okay, we now have the workforce is changing. The future of work is all about automation. Are we making sure young people are equipped for that? Or are we just saying like, okay, let's give money for them all to become agrarians and veterinarian scientists, which is where the funding came for the universities. They switch the funding on which degrees they see are valuable.
Yeah.
But where is that? Maybe it's not about like actually being working in the farm, but yet like farming is reduced. Like the number of agriculture jobs in Australia is reduced. You're now a service economy. So why are we not trying to be the leaders in technology and automation and innovation? That will require investment, and that will require investment in young people to make sure that you have the skills to be innovative, skills and resources to innovate. I saw the most interesting thing in the Washington Post as an op-ed, mm-hmm. actually maybe it was in the New York Times, one of those. And the woman was basically saying like, young people are home with nothing to do. You know, they thought they were going to go to university at this moment in time. You thought you were going to be sitting on college campuses right now.
That is true. Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're home with nothing. Not nothing. I mean, I'm sorry, that sounds so dramatic. You're home with your pets and all this. But you're home with a lot of time, energy, and space, right? Mm-hmm. And she was saying, this should be the moment that we should be using this moment to innovate, to think through big ideas, big, bold ideas that are life-changing, socially changing. And wouldn't it be amazing, in addition to that, to have a government that's saying, we'll give you $50,000 to seed a project. Okay, we'll give you $50,000 if you want to remodel your bathroom. Fine. We'll give you $50,000 for childcare. Great. We'll give you $50,000, young people, to think through a bold idea around climate change or a bold idea around the future of work or something that's pressing. Mm-hmm. And this is what is so annoying to me, is that there's going to have to be a huge investment. And so why are we not spreading the investment around? Why we can't just go back to the old channels, because this is a moment to potentially change everything. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I mean, I read the article about the budgeting, the government, kind of the crisis, the funding for the arts sector in university. I feel like I really want to hear what they have to say about it. But at the same time, it's not there. It's more like, okay, here it is.
Yeah, it's top-down decision-making, which is why it's so important to have women in the room. Women, minorities, diversity of voices in the room. Mm.
And young people as well. Because apparently
Absolutely.
It's only like 0.something% of representation in the decision-making. So
that's why young people need to go into politics and to be a part of the conversation and to be in the room.
Yeah.
There
was actually an initiative by the City of Melbourne in collaboration of RMIT and University of Melbourne. Like they incubate 30 researchers from PhD or master's programs, and they kind of train them to build something like along the line of health tech or sports tech. And they get to pitch it to the board. And if the board is interested, they could invest, like the Shark Tank kind of thing.
Yes. And government Shark Tank.
Yeah. And
yes.
It's really good. I was actually in the program, but it was just like, so it was 12 week kind of incubator, but I dropped out halfway because I was getting too busy with other things.
I feel like you should get back. Well,
I should have, yeah. But it was,
whatever. Who am I to say that to you?
But I mean, the requirements were pretty niche though, because health tech and sports tech, it kind of requires backgrounds in like chemistry and biology. And I wasn't really, I wasn't really invested into the more technical side.
Yeah.
If it was something along the line of like, you know, social justice or that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry for shaming. I'm sorry for trying to force you back into it.
Sure.
But that's, get back in. But that's exactly the point, right? Like what if you did a Shark Tank around social innovation or a social equity idea?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
You need a government Shark Tank where people are coming with their, oh my God, I love it. Where they're coming with their best ideas, and brightest ideas.
Yeah.
And you're seeding that funding a little bit to do it.
How do we propose that to the government?
We do it through this podcast. You send this podcast, right?
I'll send a policy brief.
When I was in Sweden, I have Swedish friends, and I said to them, like, because, you know, we always talk about the Swedish welfare state being so generous. Mm-hmm. And I kind of said, like, you know, what's it like to live in Sweden? Like, what does it mean? What is it like? And one of the things they said, which I thought was so interesting, is they said, because we have our healthcare insured, because, you know, there's support if you lose your job to pay your rent, because there's such a wide and deep safety net, that what it allows people to do is be bold and innovate and take risks. The threat of failure is not negligible. I mean, I don't mean to say that it's like nothing, but it's not catastrophic. Like it may be in Australia, or it would be definitely in the US to be risky. And I always thought that was so interesting, because we always think of like the Swedish welfare state of being this kind of utopia for gender equality, but their experience of it was like, no, it's really great for innovation. I can kind of try something new and bold and risky and fail, because a lot of innovations do fail, without really worrying about kind of my security and my safety and where I'm going to live and how I'm going to be. So I always think that's quite powerful in thinking about what a good government could do, is it allows people security to be risky.
Yeah.
To think bold, to try new things, to innovate.
Okay, on that note, so I was going to move forward to how should public policy respond to this then? Coming back to, you know, the differences between the workload of men and women during COVID-19.
Oh, God, it's so hard because the kids aren't going back to school. it's like, oh, because it just creates this added, the question I have is like, when is it going to be over? I mean, I know we're all thinking that question, but it's like, yeah. And what do you create in terms of a policy solution if you know that it's going to not ever be over, or it's going to go in and out and open up and then close back down? That's the uncertainty is really hard. Okay. So in order for gender equality to be kind of not exacerbated, so in terms of gender, the best next step would be, one would be to put caregiving, we need to put caregiving on the agenda. And I mean caregiving holistically. So not just thinking about childcare, but also thinking about people who are caring for spouses or partners or aging parents, because your caregiving demands don't begin or end with children. There, many people are carrying caregiving demands across their life. We need to actually make that a central policy solution, acknowledge that this is part of people's real and lived experiences, and create institutional supports around that. That could include things like ensuring flexible work is accessible to all the workers who can, role modeling that for the workforce. And what I mean by that is often flexible work can be available, or part-time work can be available, but only women take it. If only women take it, it's not going to alleviate gender inequality. It's actually just going to exacerbate gender inequality, because if only one group takes a policy, then it doesn't actually reduce the inequality. Governments need to acknowledge that this work is real work. I saw something kind of interesting that was saying, a think piece that was kind of saying like, you should pay parents to be homeschooling.
Okay.
Pay them a salary.
What are your thoughts on that?
I kind of found it compelling in that if you...
But would that incentivize women more to not
drop out?
And yeah,
thought about that as well. I thought about that too, like, is it actually just going to be women who are going to take it up? But I wonder sometimes if putting financial money behind it would make men take it up at higher rates. So if it was paid, it would be interesting, because it would be a study. You could actually study it. But if it were paid, in theory, families in which men make less than the payment, the men should step in and take the payment, right? Like if they're rationally deciding this, you might actually see greater gender equality. So that's one idea. But these are things that I think on some level, and if this is the moment to innovate, perhaps this is also the moment to innovate in the policies. You could try something like this, or trial it on a small segment of the population or in certain workplaces or whatever, government incentive or workplace incentive, and then see what happens, see what's the outcome, measure it, and then use this to scale up innovative policy. I also saw something at one point where there was a policy where there was workplaces that were offering parents or workers, I shouldn't say parents, I should say workers, like kind of discretionary funds for their caregiving demands. They could use it however they want in whatever way they wanted, but they had a little bit of a slush fund. So giving people flexible spending accounts to help reduce whatever burden they have at home, so that they can either be more productive workers or just happier citizens, might be another kind of policy solution. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they are worth exploring. I think the first step though is to engage with women and really, really government really have a conversation with them and see what they actually think and feel. Just have a consultation and design policy together with them.
And this is where you need like truly that intersectionalist perspective, right? You need equal you need to understand the experiences of women of color versus, you know, women from indigenous backgrounds versus, you need to have that approach in this, because the experiences, we're talking about women more generally, right? But as you've pointed out, like a trans woman is having a very different experience than a heteronormative woman, or we need to have this kind of lens brought into that too, I think, because the experiences will be different in the policy design and solution. But I like what you're saying. You're saying actually you need to co-design the policy solution rather than top down. Controversial co-design. Well done.
Well, thank you, Leah. It's really insightful.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of it.
It's our pleasure. All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. I hope you stay tuned for the next episodes. Bye.